Yerevan, the capital city of modern Armenia. At every angle, a celebration of architecture, art, music, and cuisine. A thriving, modern city, eyed from the horizon by Mount Ararat. Ararat is the Hebrew name for Urartu, and this city was once part of the Urartian kingdom, the United Kingdom of Van. Ararat is a familiar name to any reader of the Bible. It is, of course, the place where the Ark of Noah came to rest after the deluge. And it's not the only ancient narrative that points to this part of the world and says here in the deep past, civilization received a major reboot. The Mesopotamian story of Zeusudra also points to this region, this part of ancient Armenia in the Ararat region of Turkey and modern Armenia. These two mythologies, the Hebrew mythology of the Bible and the ancient Mesopotamian stories, speak of an ancient deluge that nearly drove the human race to extinction. And this story finds echoes in the world of ancient Persia. King Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Achaemenid Persian Empire, is the figure behind the creation of the first written forms of two important mythologies. Firstly, the mythology of Noah, and secondly, the story of Jamshid or Yima and the great and terrible winter. King Cyrus of Persia, the founder of the Achaemenid Empire in the 6th century BCE, commissioned the writing of the story of Noah and the ancient Persian story of Jamshid, Yima. In the ancient Persian story, Yima is warned by the supreme deity Ahura Mazda to protect his people from a great and terrible winter that is to come, and to gather the best of the flora and fauna of the region and take it along with his people into underground settlements. And those stories also point to this part of the world as the place where that great and terrible winter happened. Today, we speak about the Younger Dryas Cold Period, which lasted from 12,800 years ago to 11,600 years ago. It's the most recent ice age. Could this be the great and terrible winter in the stories of Jamshid and Yima? Could it be the cataclysm from which humanity had to recover that's recalled both in those stories and the stories of Zeusudra and the biblical story of Noah? Other ancient narratives point here too as a place of the dawn of civilization. The Armenian historian Moses Koronatsi identified this as the region from which humanity was repopulated by Haik, a descendant of Hapet, the son of the biblical Noah. Ancient Greek and Roman historians point to this part of the world as the place in which humanity first started to work with iron. And archaeological finds have confirmed this is the region where the Iron Age began, a great technological leap forward for humanity. In the 1200s, the post-Viking chieftain Snorri Sturluson wrote his histories of the Norse people, and he pointed to this part of the world and identified it as the place from which the Æsir, the gods of the Vikings, migrated all the way into Northern Europe and into Scandinavia. Here too was the place from which a more advanced civilization emerged. So there are many vectors pointing to this part of the world that suggest there was a reboot of civilization here, and there was a cataclysm, a great and terrible winter, which preceded it. If we go to the top of the hill here, to Erebuni, to the Fortress of Blood, we will learn more detail about these stories and understand what the ancient Urartians had to say about the significance of this part of the world. Before the foundation of Rome, King Argisti I established Erebuni, the Fortress of Blood, a citadel for the Urartian kingdom, a celebration of the United Kingdom of Van, and an intimidation of his enemies. And on the inscription here, Argisti I claims that he is the one who turned this region from barren desert into fertile farmland. And that story gets repeated by his sons and grandsons in the inscriptions they carve on the citadels they create as the history of the Urartian people continues. Yet there's something strange about the mathematics of these claims, because by the time kings Argisti and Rusa and Sarduri are making these claims that they transformed desert into fertile farmland, their people had been living here for centuries, and they were not the first Urartian kings here, so clearly something was going on before their great works. But this story of a transformation of desolate land into fertile farmland is the deep story of this region. They knew that this was the significance of this part of the world, and they wanted to show that they were part of this incredible, profound, and important moment in the story of humanity. As we explore the fortress of Erebuni, we find works of art which have survived 3,000 years in the open elements to show us a pictorial version of this great story. And here in the art at Erebuni, we see a blue sky full of flying disc-shaped shields. We see ziggurats. We see trees of life. And mysterious human-like beings, the winged Tinjir, the gods of the Urartian people. Now, when I use the word gods, I should clarify. These are advanced beings who came and assisted the Urartians' ancestors in this critical moment when human survival was hanging in the balance in the wake of the great and terrible winter of the Younger Dryas Cold period. But who were the Tinjir? Where did they come from, and how did they help? What exactly did they do to reboot a devastated ecosphere? As we look closely at the winged Tinjir, we can see that they are doing fine motor work associated with these special plants, these trees of life, which don't seem to be thriving in the wild. It looks like they're almost growing in clinical laboratory conditions. Very similar images can be found elsewhere in the kingdom of Van, in the artwork of the sanctuary at Ianus, and further south into the world of ancient Assyria. Here in what is modern-day Iran was the palace of Ashurnasirpal II, and in the exquisite art that was created for his palace, we see very detailed renderings of the same images that we find at Erebuni. Here we find winged Tinjir, who Assyriologists often referred to as genies. But what is the magic they're working? They're clearly advanced beings. The wings on their backs suggest that they have aeronautical technology. And here again is a flying disc in the sky, only this time the disc has wings on it to show you that the disc is flying and there's a person inside it. Again, the Tinjir are attending to plants, and the equipment they have with them is the mysterious handbag of the gods and the pine cone. We know the names for these artifacts. This is a bandudu, or dalu, and this is a mulilu. And though these items came in later times to be used in a symbolic and ritual way, in rituals of purification, we can see what the Tinjir used these for. In the dalu is liquid, and here is the applicator. And they are applying whatever is in that liquid to the plants to hand pollinate them. This is how the Tinjir rebooted a devastated ecosphere. The fact that hand pollination was needed at all tells us something very significant. It tells us that something was missing from the ecosphere that demanded an artificial intervention. It tells us that something had gone catastrophically wrong with the balance of the ecosystem, which is why hand pollination is now required. And to illustrate that, let me tell you the story of Edmund Albius. In 1841, on the island of Réunion, which was a French colony, a plantation owner by the name of Bellier Beaumont was inspecting his vines. And among them, he had vanilla vines. Now, vanilla was the export of Mexico, and it was highly prized and valued in Europe as a flavoring and as an aphrodisiac. People would pay a lot of money for a bit of vanilla. And so clearly, pastoralists and plantation owners were interested in growing it on a massive scale so they could make heaps of money. But the European scientists working on Mexican vanilla had not succeeded in more than 100 years of scientific experimentation. And then one day in 1841, Bellier Beaumont is inspecting some vines, and he's got these vanilla vines that he's had for about 25 years, and they've never flowered and fruited. And all of a sudden, he's seeing flowers and fruit on his vines. How in the world did that happen, he asks. Well, he had a 12-year-old slave boy with him called Edmund Albius. And the boy said, "I hand-pollinated them." "Really?" says Bellier Beaumont, and he doesn't really believe it because European scientists have been working at this for more than 100 years with all the benefits of European horticulture and agricultural science. Could a 12-year-old African slave boy really have worked out what all those scientists had failed to do? A couple of days later, he finds another vanilla vine that is now flowering and fruiting. "How in the world is this happening?" Again, Edmund Albius says, "That's one of mine. I hand-pollinated it." "Show me," says Bellier Beaumont. And so Edmund Albius shows this little technique that he's developed that means he can quite quickly hand-pollinate these plants. This was like lighting the blue touch paper for the explosion of the vanilla industry on Réunion. And within a matter of days, Bellier Beaumont is hosting workshops where Edmund Albius is showing this hand pollination technique. The reason they hadn't been able to grow Mexican vanilla in Europe is that the European bees didn't know how to pollinate them. This was something only Mexican bees knew how to do. That's why human beings had to intervene with an artificial approach and hand pollinate the plants. And once they did, the vanilla industry took off, and Réunion was soon the world's major exporter of vanilla, dwarfing the harvests from Mexico. Now, this is just an illustration of what happens when something is missing from the environment. If you don't have the right kind of bee, all of a sudden, your plants are not fruiting, and you have lost a harvest. Now, the implications of this kind of problem were explored in the 1960s by Rachel Carson when she published her book, Silent Spring. Rachel Carson was bringing attention to the fact that the petrochemical industry had found a new market for DDT, an incredibly toxic substance that had been used in chemical warfare. The new market was agriculture. It could be used as an insecticide. And it was so powerful that if you sprayed it over your field, you could guarantee to extinguish all insect life. No more pesky insects, no more pesky birds feeding on the pesky insects, no more pesky foxes feeding on the birds. In fact, no more pesky ecosystem at all. And Rachel Carson could see that a poisoned food supply would lead to poisoned human beings. That if we were eating plants that had been treated this way and eating animals that had then eaten those plants, we would begin to poison ourselves. and new forms of disease would emerge. New levels of obesity would emerge as our bodies try to fight the toxins off. And a world without natural pollination is a world on the brink of an extinction level event. This was the prophetic warning that Rachel Carson issued to the world in Silent Spring. And it was really her work that drew our government's attention to the need to protect the ecosphere in order to protect human sustainability. In the stories of the ancient Urartians, we are told that this Silent Spring has happened before. It happened in the wake of the great and terrible winter. All of a sudden, the ecosphere had changed in ways that meant human sustainability was very much in question. And the insect life that previously would have meant that crops could flourish and multiply and give you harvest year after year, that insect life was gone. And that is when the winged tingir arrived and started showing the ancestors of the Urartians how to hand pollinate plants to create new strains of plants that could be cultivated as crops and cultivated with sufficient reliability and density as to sustain whole new cities. Sadly, the story of Edmund Albius ends unhappily. He was never recognized for the work that he had done, and in fact was falsely accused of a violent crime and was imprisoned. His former boss, Bellier Beaumont, was able to show this was a miscarriage of justice and got him out of prison and campaigned the government saying, we would have no economy without Edmund Albius. This man should be on a state pension. We should be naming streets and museums after Edmund Albius, not dishonoring him like this, but the government wasn't interested. I think it interfered with the meta-narrative of French supremacy. And so Edmund Albius died at the age of 53 in poverty. They totally dishonored the person who had showed them how to hand-pollinate the trees and get the economy going again. The story of the tingir and the Urartians is the complete opposite. The Urartians never forgot the lesson in horticulture that was given them by the mysterious tingir. Carvings exist all across Lower and Upper Mesopotamia, recalling the tingir lighting the blue touch paper and doing the hand pollination that meant that barren land could become fertile farmland. And that's the story celebrated here in the paintings of Erebuni. But there are clues here as to who the tingir were, where they came from, and how they came at this most critical period in the human story. In my book, The Eden Enigma, I talk about the evidence for this ancient reboot of the world's ecosystem in the wake of the Younger Dryas Cold period. And I point to the research of Manfred Hoyne and the teams from the Max Planck Institute in Cologne, Germany, and the University of Norway in Oss. In 1998, in southeast Turkey, at Karacadağ, they identified what appears to be the first known farm in human history, the first farm to have emerged in the wake of the great and terrible winter. And in that place, a family worked out how to turn naturally occurring plants into cultivatable crops. And they did this 11 times over to create a fairly healthy diet on which they could live, along with the skills of animal husbandry providing them with livestock. These two scientific advances happened incredibly locally, so much so that Manfred Hoyne suggested it may have been one tribe or one family that made this great leap forward. But the progress of agricultural science from Southeast Turkey across the world is something that has been tracked in a number of ways. And one interesting way is through DNA research. In 2006, at Ballycastle in County Antrim, Northern Ireland, McQuaig's bar was being renovated. And as they dug up the floor, they found the remains of a human body. Now, when his DNA was analyzed, it turns out he is the ancestor of many people living in Northern Ireland today. but it was his ancestors that provided the punchline to the story, because his ancestors came from Anatolia, from the lands of ancient Armenia in the Ararat region. He was part of a migration which began 8,000 years ago, which carried with it modern farming methods, agricultural science, megalithic building technology, and we can track the progress of that migration all the way across Northern Europe, all the way to Northern Ireland. It is that same migration path identified by Snorri Sturluson, writing in the 1200s, when he speaks about the Æsir, these advanced beings moving into Northern Europe and Scandinavia and conquering those lands and becoming the gods of Viking legend. The Æsir were neighbors of and rivals of a people group called the Vanir, also advanced people. They were peers in terms of technology and power. The Æsir came from Asalan, what we would call ancient Armenia, and the Vanir, I would argue, came from the region of Van in modern-day Turkey, Van of the United Kingdom of Van, Van of the Urartian people. So where did these advanced people and the advanced Tinjir come from? There are clues in the symbols that have been left behind in ancient carvings. Here in Turkey, we see the Sun Cross and the Star Cross repeating at sacred sites. This symbol recurs in Bronze Age Sweden, and according to Snorri Sturluson, we shouldn't be surprised to find that connection. He argued that the similarity of the Scandinavian languages with the language of ancient Armenia was a real-world proof of this migration. And not only did these people take their language with them, they took their symbols with them. And so, in Bronze Age Sweden, we see the Sun Cross indicating craft in the sky. Craft large enough to take one or two people. Craft that would land in fields, and people would gather around them in awe and wonder to work out what it was they were looking at. These same symbols can be found at the sanctuary of Ayanus in modern-day Turkey. And as we saw before, flying discs occur in other places as well. In the palace of Ashurnasipal II, we find the flying disc with the person inside it. It has wings to show us that it can fly. And so there's a hint of ancient technology here. And the symbol of the ziggurat, which recurs in art at Erubuni and in Assyria and at Ayanus, also references an ancient understanding of travel between dimensions. So maybe these flying discs had come from a long way away. Maybe that blue sky full of flying disc-shaped shields was not just a display of military power represented by shields. Maybe the sky was being described, the sky that the ancestors saw, full of flying discs. Disc-shaped flying shields figure in other ancient story as well. The Roman historian Livy talks about flying disc-shaped shields intervening in the context of Roman military campaigns. And in the history of Charlemagne at the Battle of Sigismund, two flying discs are described as intervening in that campaign. Flying discs, flying shields, we're looking at the same thing. And when you consider the profile of an Urartian circular shield, put it sideways on, it's a very familiar profile to the modern eye. We wouldn't say flying shields, we would say flying saucers. In Bronze Age Sweden, we have symbols to indicate people who've come from the flying discs. And so we see carvings where the flying disc actually takes the place of the person's torso. It is an artistic shorthand for saying a person from the stars, a person from the flying disc. In the same way that a person with wings is a shorthand for a person with aeronautical technology. In Turkey, Armenia, and Assyria, we don't see people whose bodies have been replaced by flying discs, but we do see Wing Tunjir wearing things that look like wristwatches, and there's a flying disc depicted on that. Could that be another shorthand for saying a flying person from one of those flying discs? Now, on its own, that might sound very speculative, except that these ideas exist within the framework of other story. And the kings of the Urartian kingdom boasted not only of creating amazing citadels with 29-foot walls to intimidate the enemies, they boasted not only of turning desert into fertile farmland, but they were also proud that they had created doorways for Haldi. Haldi was the supreme Tunjir, the leader of the Tunjir. And these doorways, carved into solid rock faces, belong to a story that said that the Tunjir would arrive through bright doorways, and they would leave through bright doorways. Meher Kapi means a light door or a bright doorway. What does that suggest? Now, when I listen to those stories alongside ancient Norse story, I think we find a clue. In the writings of Snorri Sturluson, we hear the story of King Svedgir. And on his property one day, he finds a giant boulder which has never been there before, a giant smooth rock about the size of a house, he says. But it has a door in it. And when the door opens, there is a bright light behind it. If I picture that, what I see is a door opening and revealing an intense source of light. In a world before the technology of artificial lighting, encountering a craft with artificial light inside it would have been awe-inspiring. And any time you open the door into one of those, you'd be looking at a bright doorway, and out of it comes the Tunjir, and then interacts and helps and teaches new science, and then goes back through the bright doorway and disappears whence it came. I believe the story of the Meher Kapi, the bright doorways, is a story of ancient technology, that it's a memory of artificial lighting, that it's a memory of what people experienced every time the Tunjir showed up and disappeared. Now, these are all hints, but put alongside each other, they parallel other ancient story from around the world that speaks of interventions to support the progress of humanity through the ages. We find these stories in the Bible. We find these stories in Norse mythology. We find it in Aboriginal Australian story. We find it in the story of Native American society. We find it in Mesopotamian story from out of ancient Sumer, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria. In the Babylonian telling, the ancient helpers are called the Apkallu, and they teach farming, modern agricultural science, and civil engineering, megalithic building, city making as a whole package. And what we read about in the writings of the Greek Babylonian priest Berossus is just another version of the Urartian story of the Tunjir. In these carvings, we don't have them showing us how to build canals. We don't have them showing us how to build cities or to create legal systems or money systems. All that is in the Babylonian telling. But what we do have is the lighting of the blue touch paper. Because before you can support cities, you need agriculture. Before you can have agriculture, you need strains of plant that can thrive in your environment. And for that to happen, we have the Wing Tunjir with the Mulilu and the Dalu Bandudu hand-pollinating the trees that are going to reboot the ecosystem for a new and thriving humanity. In the Mesopotamian creation story of the Enuma Elish, we hear about Ashari, who came and taught these things. In the Hebrew stories, we hear about Asherah, who came and taught these things. In the Zulu telling, we have Mbab Mwana Warisa, who came and taught their ancestors these same things. These stories echo all around the world. What I find so interesting is that we have it in pictorial form here in the Urartian Kingdom, showing us what the Tinjir looked like, how they got here, and what they did when they assisted our ancestors in the deep past. It explains why the Urartians, in their inscriptions, always commemorated the Tinjir along with their kings. They remembered this period where the Tinjir lived among them as a golden age, and they looked forward to a time when the Tinjir would return through their bright doorways and live among them once again. And we see hints of this in the way they constructed their temples. Here at Erebuni was a Sushi temple built in ziggurat form. At Ianus was a Sushi temple built in ziggurat form as well. And that one in the interior, in the sanctuary, was oriented west to east, so that in the afternoon sun would shine into that sanctuary and make all the alabaster casings of the walls and the high altar glow with light. The carvings in there were embossed with gold leaf, and it would have been an absolute phenomenon of light in a world before artificial lighting. And I wonder if they were trying to create the conditions that would attract the Tinjir, or that would enable them to connect with the Tinjir. So creating phenomena of light was something important to them. There's a hint in the symbology of a chalice that is used, a special substance that is drunk by the priests and kings to help them have contact experiences with the Tinjir. And this, of course, echoes other protocols in the ancient world. We find it in the Kukion ceremony of ancient Greece. We find it in various protocols of ancient Egypt and ancient Persia. The Urartians were surrounded by cultures with magical chalices, all aimed at contact experiences. And they did this because they remembered the Tinjir with great affection and honor for the help that they had brought to their ancestors. They were the real pioneers of the agricultural revolution that created civilization as we know it. But where did they come from? They came through bright doorways. They came interdimensionally through some kind of ziggurat technology. They came in flying discs. But where from? One hint is to be found in modern-day Armenia at a place called Karahunj. Here is an ancient megalithic installation, an 8,000-year-old megalithic site. At least we thought it was 8,000 years old. But more recent archaeological studies of the site have identified the 8,000-year-old markers as evidence of a rebuild, and that the true age of this megalithic site is 12,000 years old. That means we have a megalithic site which straddles the Younger Dryas Cold period. It existed during and after. And what was it? It was an observatory. Viewfinding holes in the stones and contouring in the stones for observers using them tells us that the whole site was oriented around Cygnus. This was the constellation they were closely watching. Here too, we find a sanctuary oriented from west to east. Could it have been the prototype for the sanctuaries we find across the Urartian Kingdom? And it's a convention which continues to the present day, so that Tertullian, writing in the period of early Christianity, says that is the way you should face when you pray. You should face east. But the convention predates Christianity by 10,000 years. The name Karahunj means speaking stones. So again, we have that hint of a hope of contact with those upon whom we're gazing when we set our sights on the Cygnus constellation. Now, as I study ancestral narratives around the world, I find particular constellations repeating in the ancient stories. When I listen to Cherokee friends talking about the helpers who came and taught their ancestors the principles of living in harmony with the land, they point to the Pleiades. Other story points to Sirius. Other story points to Orion. And here in ancient Armenia, we're looking at the Cygnus constellation. From the beginning, our ancestors were fascinated by the idea of contact with beings from the stars. But here in the carvings of the ancient Urartians, we have a more developed story of contact. Do carvings in the mountains of Turkey carry ancient memories of ET contact from the dawn of civilization? My book, The Eden Enigma, says yes. And so we look at DNA research, we look at archaeological research, we look at ancestral narratives, and we examine the language of symbols which have carried stories older than every religion we can name on the planet today, that take us back to the worldview of our ancestors before any of those religions emerged, back to an understanding of who we really are, of our place in the universe, and how it is that we came to be the way we are. Read The Eden Enigma and you'll understand why I will keep returning to this part of the world. This year I'm working with Matt LaCroix in putting together a movie about human timelines and what the stories here have to say to that topic. And in September, there's the opportunity for you to tour with us as we continue our research here. In the meantime, I invite you to join me in The Eden Enigma as we explore the ancient symbology of Armenia and Turkey and sit at the feet of our ancestors with incredible stories to tell, which I believe really enrich not only our understanding of history, but help us to look to the skies today with a more optimistic worldview as to what contact might mean in the present. Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV. The Eden Enigma. Do ancient carvings in the mountains of Turkey carry memories of ET contact from the dawn of civilization? Harvard's professor of astrophysics, Avi Loeb, says the brilliant Paul Wallace provides a fascinating answer. Go to Amazon for your copy of The Eden Enigma.